This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So thanks so much for the invitation. It's a great pleasure to be here. And today I'm going to be talking about the legacy of archaic admixture in present-day humans. And so to set the stage here, based on genetic analyses of present-day populations, we've built up a fairly good broad outline of the history of modern humans. So for example, we know that modern humans evolved in Africa, and about 100,000 years ago, there was a dispersal outside of Africa to the rest of the world. We also know, based on archaeological evidence, that during this dispersal, modern humans overlapped with another archaic human population, the Neanderthal. And so this begs the question whether these two populations that overlapped potentially met and interbred. And so several studies have tried to answer this hypothesis, but in the last 5 years, there have been some major breakthroughs that allow us to get whole genomes from ancient human populations. In particular, we have genomes from the Neanderthals and their sister group, the Denisovans. And we'll hear a little bit more about the technical challenges that enable the breakthrough in the later talks. But what I'd like to focus on today is the fact that once we have these ancient whole genome sequences, we can pretty much definitively answer the question of whether there was interbreeding between these two groups. And so a number of studies have shown that there was indeed interbreeding or gene flow. For example, we now know that non-African populations trace about 2% of their genetic ancestry back to the Neanderthals. We also know that there was Denisovan gene flow into some present-day human populations. For example, populations from island Oceania have about 3 to 6% of their genetic ancestry tracing back to the Denisovans. This is over and above the 2% that they inherit from the Neanderthals. So the big picture is all non-Africans today carry a small amount of archaic ancestry. And at first blush, this might seem like a small contribution. But when we examine this further, one thing that we need to keep in mind is the Denisovans and the Neanderthals were highly diverged from modern human populations at the time of admixture. So we think that they were separated by at least a couple of hundreds of thousands of years. And as a result, these populations accumulated novel mutations that were never seen in the modern human population, and these novel mutations entered modern humans through the admixture process. So we estimate that about 10% of the SNPs at the time of admixture in non-Africans could have been of Neanderthal origin. So a hypothesis is that these archaic admixtures were having a potentially large impact on human biology. So as one concrete example of the potential impact of archaic admixture, we were involved in a genome-wide association study, a study that aims to determine genetic variants associated with type 2 diabetes in Mexican Americans. So in this study, we determined a novel variant found in this gene called SLC16A11, and we found that this gene had a unique geographic distribution. So when we looked at the variant in this gene that confers increased risk for type 2 diabetes, we found that the risk-increasing variant is found at appreciable frequencies in the Americas, is essentially absent in Africa, and is present at low frequency everywhere else. And what we found is that this risk-increasing variant at this gene matches the genomic sequence found in one of the Neanderthal genomes that had been sequenced. So what we determined was this was a variant that had introgressed into modern human populations from Neanderthals. Now, a number of other studies have looked at specific genetic positions, genetic loci, and have documented substantial contributions of archaic ancestries at these loci. So here is a not very representative list. But what we wanted to do is go beyond single loci analyses and ask, what does the distribution of Neanderthal ancestry look if you were to look across the genome? So we wanted to go from single loci to a genome-wide assessment. And to do this, we need to build a map of archaic local ancestry. So what do we mean by that? Basically, what we want to do is to go along an individual person's genome and label the positions where they carry archaic ancestry. And so here is a cartoon that depicts what's going on and why we need to do this. So we have a modern human genome admixing with an archaic human genome. And if you look at the descendants of this interbreeding, because of the way the genome is transmitted in every generation, it gets broken down by a process called recombination. And as a result, if you look at the descendant of this interbreeding event, this descendant's genome is going to have this mosaic pattern, where some portions of the genome trace their ancestry to the modern human, and others trace their ancestry to the archaic human population. And so what we'd like to be able to do is look at a present-day individual's genome and figure out which are the portions that are red and which are the portions that are blue. So to be able to do this, we came up with a statistical model. And what this model allows us to do is to infer these locations of archaic ancestry. So specifically, we're going to look at a target genome. This could be any genome that we are interested in. And we compare this target genome to the genome of the Neanderthal, the Denisovan, as well as to a reference panel of African individuals. So we are looking at Africans because this is a population that we assume has little archaic ancestry. It's a reasonable assumption, but not entirely true, but we work with that. And our goal is to look at this target genome, and for every position, which we call a SNP here along this target genome, we'd like to label the ancestry, or more precisely, the local ancestry of this individual. So we'd like to be able to say that this SNP at the target individual is Neanderthal in ancestry, whereas this other SNP is modern human in ancestry. So I'm going to give you a little bit of intuition for what goes under the layers of this statistical model that allows us to make these inferences. So the basic idea is we are going to be looking at patterns of genetic variation that are informative of archaic ancestry. So here's an example where we're going to be looking at features of genetic variation that are informative of Neanderthal ancestry. So here we are looking at a single position in the genome where we are comparing the target genome to the Neanderthal, the Denisovan, and the Africans. And what we see here is a genealogy or a tree that relates these genomes at this position. And what we see at this position is that there is a mutation that clusters the target and the Neanderthal genome to the exclusion of all the other genomes. So when we see this pattern, we are likely to think that this is a position that has come into the target genome from Neanderthal admixture. On the other hand, here is another position where there is a mutation that clusters the target with the Denisovan and the Africans to the exclusion of the Neanderthals. And when we see this, we conclude the opposite, that this is a position that is unlikely to carry Neanderthal ancestry. So these kinds of features go into the statistical model, which figures out what is an optimal way of combining these features to get the best possible predictions. And similarly, we can also do a statistical model that allows us to predict Denisovan ancestries. So we applied an initial version of this statistical model to a data set that comes from what is called the 1000 Genomes Project. And this already gave us some very interesting insights. But a limitation of that data set was that this data set had a small sampling of populations from outside of Africa. And a second limitation was that it lacked any individuals who carry Denisovan ancestry, so we can make no inferences about the Denisovan contributions to modern human populations. So instead, we applied this data set, this method, to a new data set. This is a rich genomic data set that's called the Simons Genome Diversity Project. It has genome sequences from over 100 non-African populations. And most importantly, we have in this data set 20 genomes from Oceania from individuals who have substantial Denisovan ancestries. So we applied our method to this data set. And the first thing we'd like to be able to conclude is that the method is giving us accurate inferences about archaic ancestries. So one way to do this is to make sure that the inferences are consistent with everything we know about human history. So the way we do this is we take the inferences that come out of the statistical model, we average it across an individual's genome, and compute what proportion of an individual's genome is archaic in ancestry. So in this particular case, we are asking what proportion of an individual's genome is Neanderthal in ancestry. And so what we have here is a circle for every population, and the color is telling us whether you have low levels of Neanderthal ancestry to high levels of Neanderthal ancestry. So the first thing we observed is, in general, non-Africans carry substantially more Neanderthal ancestry compared to South African hunter-gatherers, which are not included here. But this is what we expect based on our previous demographic models, which tell us that there was Neanderthal admixture into non-Africans after they split from Africans. We also observe that when you look at Eastern non-African populations, they carry more Neanderthal ancestry compared to West Eurasians, which has also been a previous observation consistent with the literature. Now we can do the analogous thing for Denisovan ancestry. And what we see here is that Oceanian populations have substantially more Denisovan ancestry compared to mainland Eurasian populations. Further, amongst the mainland Eurasians, there seems to be more Denisovan ancestry in East Asians compared to West Eurasians. Again, all of these are consistent with previous results. Now, when we looked at the data further, there was one element of surprise and a novel result. And the novel result is that several populations in South and East Asia tend to have an excess of Denisovan ancestry that had not been observed before. So these are populations like the Sherpa, which is a population from Nepal, the Tibetans, and Bengali, who are a population from East India. It turns out that this is a trace amount of Denisovan ancestry that they carry. We estimate that it's about 5 parts in 1,000, which is why you need these sensitive statistical methods to see these Denisovan contributions. Now, one question we were interested in is, can this excess of Denisovan ancestry in South Asian populations be explained by a mixture between Eastern non-Africans who have more Denisovan ancestry with West Eurasians who have less Denisovan ancestry? To see this, we plotted the Denisovan ancestry as a function of what proportion of your genome is related to non-West Eurasians. And what we see is generally, as you get closer to the non-West Eurasians, you have more Denisovan ancestry. But when you look at South Asian populations, they have systematically more that can be explained by this model. So what this is telling us is one of several things. A model that is consistent with this observation, though not the only model, is that there were actually 3 Denisovan integration events in the history of modern human populations. One in the history of the Papuans or the Oceanians, the second in the history of the East Asians, and the third in the history of South Asian populations. Now we decide to zoom in, and instead of looking at how archaic ancestry changes across individuals, we'd like to look at how archaic ancestry changes as we move along the genomes. So here, as we move along the circle, we are moving along the genome looking at different chromosomes. And the outermost circle is telling us what is the Denisovan ancestry proportion in the Oceanians. And each of the inner circles are telling us what is the Neanderthal ancestry proportion in different continental populations. And the key observation is the colors along these circles tell us which are positions in the genome where there is detectable proportions of archaic ancestry. So the key takeaway from this figure is the archaic ancestry doesn't seem to be randomly scattered along an individual's genome. There are certain hotspots where there is an elevated proportion of archaic ancestry, so we call them peaks. And then there are certain other positions in the genome where nobody seems to be carrying archaic ancestry, which we term deserts. So this was another surprise, and we'd like to figure out what is going on in these peaks and deserts of archaic ancestry. So we looked at one, or the most extreme example of a peak. So this is a locus that overlaps a gene called basonuclein 2. And in the 1,000 genomes European population, we find that about 60% of individuals, European individuals today, carry the Neanderthal variant of the allele. This needs to be contrasted with the 2% who would have carried it 50,000 years ago. Essentially, the Neanderthal variant has increased from 2% to 60% over the last 50,000 years. This is not an isolated example, and we find of the order of 200 loci with elevated Neanderthal ancestries in the different non-African populations, and about 50 loci with elevated Denisovan ancestry in the Oceanian populations. So these are all potential candidates for what we call archaic adaptive introgression. Putting it simply, these are places in the genome where the archaic allele conferred an adaptive benefit in the modern human population, which is why it rose up in frequencies. So we'd like to understand what might be driving this increase in frequencies at these positions. And that turns out to be a really challenging problem. One way we try to address that is by looking at sets of genes that are known to be associated with certain functions or certain biological processes. And we asked, are these sets of genes harboring an excess of archaic ancestry much more than we'd expect? And so we find several sets of genes that show an elevated proportion of archaic ancestry much more than we'd expect. So for example, genes that are involved in keratin filament formation. So keratin is a protein that's found in hair and skin. are enriched for Neanderthal ancestry across all the non-African populations. Similarly, we find that genes involved in trisomy receptors, these are genes that are involved or important for olfaction, tend to have elevated proportions of Denisovan ancestry. So this again allows us to narrow down what the selection pressures might be, but still we are quite some ways away from figuring out what the exact sequence of processes were that drove these archaic variants to high frequencies. Next, we turn our attention to deserts. So these are large regions, tens of millions of bases long, where we cannot detect either Neanderthal or Denisovan ancestry. And even more impressively, there are four such regions in the genome that are deserts for both Neanderthal and Denisovan ancestry. So here is one example. This is a desert on chromosome 7, and it contains a number of genes within this region. But one gene that caught our eye because of the prior work associated with it is a gene called FOXP2. So this is a gene that's shown to be important for speech and language. So a possibility here is that these deserts of archaic ancestry are places in the genome that are resistant to archaic introgression. And a reason for that is that these are places that are important for the modern human phenotype. The challenge, again, is that these are large regions of the genome, and trying to localize what might the changes be that make them resistant to introgression is actually quite challenging. So we decided to look at this in a slightly more quantitative manner. And the way we did this is we chopped up the genome according to a measure of the selective strength in that region of the genome. And we asked, how does the archaic ancestry change in different portions of the genome? So the x-axis, as we go from right to left, is going in directions of stronger selective constraint. And what we find is the archaic ancestry, whether we are looking at Neanderthals or the Denisovans, decreases as we move towards the strongly selectively constrained regions of the genome. So this is consistent with the observation that there's been purifying selection to remove archaic alleles. And there are several models that have been proposed. One of these is that these archaic alleles are deleterious and they're being purged from the human population. Another one that we've also proposed is one of hybrid sterility, where these populations have diverged and have accumulated genetic incompatibilities that are not tolerated on each other's genetic background. So I'm just going to conclude very quickly. I've talked about statistical models for inferring maps of archaic ancestry. And so by combining these sensitive statistical models with the rich ancient and modern genomic data sets, we can make some very fine scale inferences. And the kinds of inferences lead us to conclude that there is a lot of complexity in the demographic histories of these populations. We'll learn more about it in later talks. And when we look at the variation along the genome, clearly this is affected by selection, but there's also demography at play here. And a major challenge for us is to separate out demography and selection and different kinds of selection from each other. With that, I'd like to acknowledge my colleagues at Harvard, colleagues at the Max Planck, and members of the Neanderthal Genome Consortium for comments and criticism at different stages of work. Thanks.
So as Ed mentioned, I'm sort of a biochemist by training, and I've been wondering for many years sort of how it is possible actually that ancient DNA is preserved in fossils for over tens of thousands of years. And I'm also wondering how much further can we go in time? So how will it be in 5 or 50 years, perhaps, if I can still see that? If someone giving a talk here, of what material are they going to talk about? Is it 1 million years? In order to address the question of how long DNA can be preserved in bones, I think it's worthwhile to look a bit into bone structure. The bone consists of two major components. One is an organic component, collagen. It's a protein that gives some level of elasticity to bones so that they don't break easily. And then there's another very interesting component, which makes up to 50% of the bone mass, which is hydroxyapatite. It's sort of a form of calcium phosphate that has a very interesting biochemical property, which is shown in this experiment here. If you take a mixture of DNA of different sizes, sort of similar to what you might find in an ancient bone, and you dissolve this DNA in water and you add a suspension of pure hydroxyapatite, the DNA will instantly bind to the hydroxyapatite. And then you can wash that hydroxyapatite powder often with water or with all sorts of low-salt buffers, and you will not release this DNA from hydroxyapatite. It will only come down if you give it a harsh chemical treatment, such as using a decalcifier to break up the hydroxyapatite structure or using a strong phosphate buffer. And you can repeat this experiment using ancient bone. And so this is shown here. So you, the DNA, pool of DNA fragments immediately binds to ancient bone that is also known to contain endogenous ancient DNA, and that's of age 40 to 100,000 years. And it only gets comes down after intense treatment with chemicals. And that even works if you have bones that are much older, and bones that are actually known, at least at the current level of resolution, not to carry any ancient DNA, like this one from a site in Germany that's 600,000 years old, or this bone of a dinosaur that's 80 million years old. So while this is sort of a very interesting proof that you can recover DNA from dinosaurs, it's not yet proof that this can also be done for authentic dinosaur DNA. But an important take-home message here is that the bone structure itself sort of provides a very good carrier for DNA. And there's basically no limit in the DNA binding capacity of bone over time. So what is it then that sort of limits us in our ability to study ancient DNA through time? And obviously there are also other processes taking place that will degrade DNA over time. There are a lot of reactions, some hydrolytic, some oxidative reactions, and the ones that are thought to damage DNA most are those ones with the red arrow here, which is hydrolysis of purine bases, so A's, the letters A's and G's coming off the DNA, and then over time your DNA breaks down into shorter and shorter molecules. And you can model this, for example, here, assuming a strand break every 50 base pairs in your DNA, then you will see that you have very few long molecules, but a lot of very short molecules. And the more you damage your DNA, the more this distribution gets shifted to the left end until sort of all your DNA has disappeared or broken down into fragments that are too short to make sense of. So for that, and it's important to know that these chemical processes are temperature dependent. So they occur much slower at lower temperature, which is also why if you look for the world record of sort of ancient DNA genome sequencing, you have to go to the permafrost. So there's this, 2 years ago, I think, there was a very exciting paper published, an almost full genome of a 700,000 years old horse from permafrost. It gets more complicated if you leave permafrost, and if you're then sort of, if your fossils are subject to these temperature cycles that occur during the Pleistocene. So for the last roughly 100,000 years, temperature were mostly colder than they are now, but then you enter these interglacials where you have elevated temperature, and these are very detrimental to DNA preservation. Nonetheless, sort of being limited to the last 100,000 years and temperate climate zones is not too bad after all. There are some very interesting events taking place in human evolution. And one of them has been mentioned before by Sriram, is the human dispersal out of Africa, which may have occurred sort of with the major wave around 50,000 years ago. And so humans, when they left Africa, there were still Neanderthals living in sort of Western and Central Eurasia. And we have generated genome sequences from several Neanderthals, also one to very high quality. And we could make inferences from these genome sequences that show that Neanderthals are, as expected, also by morphological evidence, a sister group to modern humans. So they're a different evolutionary lineage. But we could also see in the analysis of these genomes, it was first time shown by Ed Green in 2010, that there was actually admixture going on. So that that there was some contribution of the Neanderthal genome into modern humans. And we've seen more recently sort of a weak signal also for the other way around, so that some Neanderthals may have picked up modern human DNA when they interacted. So if the analysis of genomes from the last 100,000 years has also brought us to Denisovans. So they were discovered based on just a few small fossils, a tiny finger bone, and a few teeth that were found in Denisova cave. And based on the analysis of their genome, we could show that they are indeed a sister group to Neanderthals. So they are like the Eastern brothers or sisters of Neanderthals, and they have contributed also their DNA to modern humans. But unlike Neanderthals, not to all humans outside of Africa, But to humans in Eastern Asia, and mostly like in the highest proportion of ancestry of Denisovan ancestry you find in Oceania here, which makes us believe that Denisovans were once much more widespread than just look in the Denisova cave. Now, the problem is still we are looking sort of at the tips of these evolutionary branches. So we are looking at the last sort of Denisovans, the last Neanderthals, sort of relatively late modern humans, and it would be tremendously exciting to look further down in the past and try to understand sort of what are the genomes like of these ancestors, of the archaic ancestor, and what's for me would be very exciting is to sort of find the genome of the sort of last ancestor between humans and the archaics. Now, as I mentioned before, chemical reactions make DNA break down in very short pieces. So if you want to address that problem from a biochemical perspective, what you have to do is you have to go for these extremely short fragments and hoping that you would find some surviving DNA in this size range. So you, the question then is, where are we currently in doing this? And this is sort of a typical fragment size distribution of DNA sequences that we recover from fossils. Sort of from a few years ago, from the world record holder, the horse genome, the 700,000-year horse genome that was sequenced by a group in Copenhagen. And as you can see, the DNA sequences coming from this horse are indeed quite short, sort of centering on about 70 base pairs. But even so, we could in principle make use also of sequences that are shorter than this, up to maybe 30, 35 base pairs. So the question is, are these sequences lost in sample preparation, or is it that truly there's no longer DNA preserved in these bones? So I and several graduate students in my group have sort of intensely looked at this over the past years, and we've basically gone through every step of the sample preparation process and trying to refine it so that we maximize the number of molecules that we keep in each step and that we also extract the shortest possible DNA fragments. And this starts, obviously, with DNA extraction, so it's a process of isolating the DNA fragments from the bones or teeth and purifying them so that they can be used in downstream reactions. There's a second very important process involved in DNA sequencing these days, which is library preparation. And in this process, you attach short artificial pieces of DNA to the ends of each DNA fragment, and these short adapters, so-called adapters, can then be used to make thousands of copies of each molecule and then also to prime the sequencing reaction and read the molecule out. As a last step of this process, you're taking the sequences coming out of the sequencer and trying to match them to a known reference genome. In our case, it's the human reference genome, which has been sequenced to very high quality in 2001. And even this process actually has some issues, and we are also working on sort of optimizing the bioinformatic algorithm that we use to identify human-like sequences. Now, going through all this sort of in several cycles for several years, we eventually determined the fragment size distribution in ancient bones that looks more like this. So this is what I've shown you before. This was the distribution of fragments from the permafrost. This now is a typical fragment size distribution that we see in most bones from caves and temperate climate zones. And what you see, indeed, there are very, very short fragments in the bones. Many fragments much shorter than we can currently use for analysis because sequence is then so short you can't even identify it as a human sequence anymore. But it's not that we are sort of losing these long ones and now we gain the short molecules. Indeed, it's sort of an extra gain of short molecules. So this here, the small black stripes are the fragment size distribution that I've shown you before, and sort of this gain of short molecules is on top of this. Now, from the sort of methods perspective, we are all ready to sequence older DNA than before, but the problem, of course, still is you also need a site that allows an extraordinary level of DNA preservation. And we were lucky enough to identify this site in northern Spain. The site is called the Cima de los Huesos, the Pit of Bones, and it carries the remains of at least 28 virtually complete hominin skeletons that were dated to 430,000 years ago. And this is sort of the biggest assemblage of fossils from the Middle Pleistocene in Eurasia, the time period preceding 130,000 years. The site is very special in that it's sort of 30 meters below ground, It's very difficult to reach it. It's only through a sort of very hidden cave entrance, and you have to sort of crawl in there. So there's very little air exchange with outside, and very stable temperature in the cave, around 11 degrees. And this basically makes it a perfect fridge. Now, we were indeed successful in recovering DNA fragments from that from several fossils from this site. And in blue here, I'm showing sort of the part of the size distribution where we find evidence for the presence of short, highly damaged ancient DNA molecules. The rest of this distribution is mostly made up by microbial sequences and modern human contamination. Now, the problem is there were very few sequences only coming out. So in order to make some sense out of them, we first had to look at one particular type of DNA in the mammalian cell, which is mitochondrial DNA. And this DNA is special in that it's not present in only two copies per cell, as the 23 chromosomes that everyone knows about, but it's indeed present in several copies in hundreds of mitochondria. So for each part of the nuclear genome, you have hundreds of copies of the mitochondrial genome. And even so, we still needed around 2 grams of material, which is a lot with current day standards, to just get one sort of nice assembly of the mitochondrial genome. And if you want to compare this to what we typically get from late Pleistocene sites, from sort of moderately preserved Neanderthal remains, there we get many more copies of the mitochondrial genome from much less material. In summary, it's about 1,000 times less than what we've seen in other Neanderthal samples. So having the mitochondrial genome, we could build a tree from mitochondrial DNA. And the first thing to note here is that if you look just at the size of the branches, you will see that all of these lineages here, modern humans, Neanderthals, Denisovans, they are relatively long. And the Cima de los Huesos sequence sits on a short branch, indicating its extraordinary age, right? While the other individuals kept mutating, this individual died a few hundred thousand years earlier and thus lacks mutations. Further than this, this tree is actually very confusing. And this is because mitochondrial DNA, even though it is preferable for technical reasons, only shows gives very limited information about the ancestry. It's only inherited from mothers to their children, and it reflects only a small part of the population history. So instead of looking at mitochondrial DNA, it's much better to look at nuclear DNA and to determine how this individual was related to the Denisovans and Neanderthals. And sort of after screening more samples from the site, we were eventually able to recover as much as a thousandth of the genome of an individual from Cima de los Huesos. And there's extremely little data, but still it's enough to do a very simple analysis. Now, having so few sequences, one thing you cannot do is actually compare these sequences to a high-quality reference genome and then ask where does it differ. And then you see these red dots here which indicate sequencing errors, because on average, 1 in 100 base pairs is wrong. But what you can do instead is use a trick and use a data set, a reference data set of high-quality genomes, including the genomes of many present-day humans, but also the archaic genomes that we have sequenced to high quality, and identify positions in the genome where, for example, the Neanderthal differs from all the other humans, where the Denisovans differ from Neanderthals, humans, and the chimpanzee, and so on. And then you can just count at positions overlapping these sites, how does the Cima de los Huesos sequence look like? And we did identify 100 sequences that overlap sites that are sort of diagnostic for Neanderthals, and 42 of them actually showed the Neanderthal state. In contrast to this, we had a sort of roughly equal number of sequences matching a Denisovan-specific site, but only 10 share the Denisovan state. So, and this is a highly significant difference, and there's a very simple inference from this, is that indeed the Cima de los Huesos hominins were closer to Neanderthals than Denisovans, which also means that Neanderthals and Denisovans must have diverged by the time these individuals lived. So one sort of important message from this is that it gives us, for the first time, a relatively stable anchor point in the timeline of human evolution. So both the geological dating methods as well as sort of the branch length of the mitochondrial DNA that we've looked at arrive at an age estimate about 400,000 years. And so we can say that the common ancestor of these two archaic lineages must have lived before. Now, there have been in the past a number of attempts to infer the population split times using the genomes of Neanderthals and Denisovans. And then depending on the parameters that you use, you arrive at different ages. If I use the most compatible estimates, the estimates that are most compatible with this number, then indeed I would estimate that the human archaic divergence is something like 550 to 700, 800,000 years ago, and probably even towards sort of the higher end of this. So the sort of the good or the bad news is, as you will, that if you want to sequence that common ancestor between humans and Neanderthals, we have to go much further back in time. So there are still challenges waiting for us here. And yeah, I'm looking forward to hopefully being able to present this at some point. I want to thank all my colleagues in Leipzig, especially Svante Pebo, who's sort of the mastermind behind all the ancient DNA work in Leipzig, the Max Planck Society for the very good funding that we have, and all the colleagues in my lab and the graduate students, as well as, importantly, the our collaborators in Spain who've done brilliant work in excavating these samples very cleanly, I must say. And thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here. I'm going to be talking about some other genomes that contribute to what makes us human. So this may look like a photograph of outer space, but these pinpoint points of light are not stars. They are, in fact, the glowing genomes of millions of bacterial cells on the human surface of human teeth. This is dental plaque. Now, the human body contains an estimated 30 trillion human cells, and by the latest estimate, 40 trillion bacterial cells. And so if you add these two numbers up together, you will find that we are more than 50% bacterial. Now, 40 trillion bacterial cells is an incredible number. And at an average length of just over 1 micron, if you were to line them up, just the ones in your own body alone, end to end, they would actually wrap around the entire Earth and span more than 20,000 miles. 40 trillion bacterial cells is truly an astronomical number, and even this fails to capture the immensity of this number because there are only about 300 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy. And so the number of bacteria in and on your body actually exceed the number of stars in more than 100 galaxies. So at this point, you may be wondering how you appear human at all. And the answer is that although numerous, these bacteria are also very small. On average, they're 1,000 times smaller than a human cell. And so when you add them all up together, they make up about 2% of your body weight, or roughly 1.5 kilograms. Now, that's a really interesting number because that's about the same weight as your brain and your liver. And so some have argued that we should start to think of the microbiome as an additional organ system. Now, most of these bacteria are concentrated in the gut, and specifically in the distal colon. And in feces, they're actually concentrated to an extraordinary degree. There are over 100 billion viable bacterial cells per gram of feces. And so if you follow the math through, that means with each trip to the toilet, you actually lose 20% of your total body cells. But don't worry, you regenerate them very quickly after your next meal. Now, in addition to the gut, a smaller but also very important fraction of your microbiome lives within your oral cavity, and there they inhabit the buccal mucosa, the surface of the tongue, and the surfaces of your teeth, where they're called dental plaque. Now, the oral microbiome actually plays a very important role in the history of microbiology, because the first undisputed description of bacteria comes from a letter written by Antony van Leeuwenhoek to the Royal Society of London approximately 300 years ago, in which he described very many small animals which moved themselves very extravagantly within his dental plaque. He drew many of these organisms, and he tried to count them, but he eventually gave up, and he wrote, "The number of these animals in the scurf of man's teeth are so numerous that I believe they exceed the number of men in a kingdom." Now, if anything, this is a gross understatement, because we now know that there are nearly as many bacteria on the surface of your teeth as there are humans on Earth, and each day you swallow an average of 80 billion bacteria in your saliva. So in addition to being numerous, these bacteria also contain an immense diversity of genes, and on average, there are about 150 times more genes in your microbiome than in your human genome. This collector bacterial genome is so large that it's often referred to as your accessory genome. And in fact, you require these genes in order to perform some of your most basic human life functions. And this has led some to describe the relationship between humans and their microbes as that of a superorganism, like a colony of bees, so many independent organisms contributing together, or more recently as a holobiont, an ecosystem so tightly interdependent that it behaves as a single organism, like coral. So rather than just being a leaf on the great tree of life, in some ways humans are actually more like a tree house, a home woven from many permanent and transient microbial inhabitants. And yet we have only very recently come to even notice this large number of underexplored and mostly nameless microorganisms that inhabit the human body. In fact, it was only in 2001 that Joshua Lederberg coined the term microbiome in order to, quote, signify the ecological community of commensal, symbiotic, and pathogenic microorganisms that literally share our body space and have been all but ignored as determinants of health and disease. Now, this is rather remarkable, because these microbial communities perform essential major functions within their host bodies that include various aspects of digestion, vitamin production and drug metabolism, education of the immune system, and defense against pathogens. But the microbiome can also be a source of infectious agents. For example, the oral microbiome is the natural reservoir for numerous respiratory opportunistic pathogens that are responsible for infections ranging from pneumonia to meningitis. And the oral and gut microbiomes have been implicated in several chronic inflammatory diseases, including a cardiovascular disease, where in a recent study it was found that more than 80% of diseased valve and arterial tissues contain oral bacteria. So the microbiome clearly plays a pivotal role in human biology, and therefore it is critical to understand its evolution and changing ecology through time. And one way we can do this is we can investigate the ancestral human microbiome by directly measuring and analyzing it from archaeological material. Now, ancient DNA studies have long focused on the analysis of bones and teeth, and we've made major advancements studying these tissues, and we've been able to, for example, recover host and pathogen DNA and reconstruct the entire genomes of extinct animals, archaic humans, and even ancient pathogens. But studying the microbiome has been very challenging. The human body decays rapidly after death. In some cases, mummification can occur, but in the vast majority of instances, we are left with only a skeleton. But there is one microbiome that routinely persists after death, and that is something called dental calculus. This is what it essentially is, dental plaque that has spontaneously calcified during life. You know this by the name tartar, which is what your dentist calls it. It calcifies during life in a way, it actually is the only part of your body that fossilizes while you're still alive, and therefore persists like your skeleton long after death. This is just a close-up image of dental calculus, so you can kind of see what it is. If you're wondering what this looks like in a living person, here's an image here. It's this calcified microbial matrix on the surface of teeth. This particular example is from a woman who died approximately 1,000 years ago. And we can zoom in on this particular tooth here, and here I've just shown that same tooth now in cross-section using scanning electron microscopy, and we can zoom in on this calculus deposit that you can see on the surface of the enamel. There it is right there, and we're going to zoom in again on this part right here, and one of the things that's very clear immediately is that it has structure. It has a layered structure, and that is because dental calculus forms incrementally. Dental plaque undergoes spontaneous calcification, which kills the microorganisms inside but also entombs them. And then another layer of dental plaque forms, and this process repeats. And over time, it builds up layers like tree rings or layers of an onion. But what's really significant about this is what it means is that we have an ordered record of this person's life history from the earliest period, closest to the surface of the teeth, to the latest period of life, just before they died. This structure never remodels, and therefore is a remarkable record of this person's life history. We can zoom in even further and actually see the individual microbial cells that have been just calcified in situ. We can also decalcify it and use stains like Gram stain to visualize these bacteria. Remarkably, when you remove the mineral, the bacteria do not disintegrate. And in fact, you can see individual microbial cells here. So these are individual Gram-positive bacteria, for example, here, still with cell wall intact. And what to me was most remarkable is we tried kind of on a lark. We didn't think it would work. We decided to use another stain, in this case, Hook's dye, which is very similar to DOPPY, if you've ever used that. It's a DNA dye. It binds to double-stranded DNA. And this is the image we got after that, which you saw in the beginning. This is the only archaeological material that I know to exist that has so much DNA inside that you can actually see it under a microscope. This property turns out to be pretty remarkable for calculus. If we're going to use by comparison, let's just sort of talk a little bit about bone and dentin. Those are the tissues that are most commonly studied. They actually have very little DNA inside, even when a person is alive. So bone, for example, has fewer than 1,000 cells per milligram. It's almost acellular. We have, typically in archaeological context, we recover very little DNA, typically less than a nanogram of DNA per milligram that we study. And even that is mostly environmental bacteria that have invaded postmortem. So here's it's just some data that we've generated in my own lab. We looked at 4 teeth from different parts of the world, different time periods, and we looked to see what the endogenous content was of dentin. What we find is that only a tiny fraction of that DNA is actually human. Most of it, the vast majority, is postmortem environmental bacteria that are decomposing the teeth. And on average, we get something like 0.1 to 8% human DNA. So very, very low amounts of endogenous DNA. Calculus is completely different. First off, it starts off with far more cells. So on average, it has more than 200 million cells per milligram. In our lab, we've isolated in excess of 500 nanograms of DNA per milligram we've studied. And what's also really remarkable is we have very low contamination from environmental sources. So these are these same teeth, but now we've analyzed the calculus from them. And what you can see is the endogenous content, the oral microbiome proportion, is much, much higher. It's on the order of 60 to 80%. We can look then at pairs again of calculus and dentin, and we can see that the amount of DNA that we can recover, this is a logarithmic scale, is on average about 2 orders of magnitude higher, so nearly 100 times more DNA in calculus than in dentin, and in some cases 1,000 times higher. We thought in the beginning this might just be because it starts off with more DNA, and so we decided to test this. We took a tooth that was very diseased, it had a massive carious lesion and also a giant abscess, so this would have had tons of bacterial DNA, tons of bacteria at the time this person died, and we expected that we might see elevated levels of DNA from these samples, and in fact we don't. We find they're almost the same as what we see for healthy dentin. It seems to imply that there's something special about calculus that facilitates DNA preservation. We can then actually go in and say, well, what do we find in calculus? This is this amazing structure. It's full of DNA. What sorts of information can we learn from it? Well, we can break it down into different categories, and we can say, well, about 99% of it is bacterial. That makes sense. We know this is made of dental plaque. Dental plaque is primarily a microbial matrix. But about 1% is quite interesting. We have a little bit more than 0.5%, which is eukaryotic. That's mostly host and dietary. And we also find a tiny bit of archaea and a little bit of virus. The virus is actually bacteriophage, which are viruses that infect bacteria. We can also extract proteins from dental calculus, and we can also classify them. What we find is about 80% of the proteins are bacterial in origin, and about 20% are human. And I'll come back to that in just a few minutes. Let's focus on the bacteria first. We've identified more than 1,000 species, but the vast majority, more than 85% of the sequences, bacterial sequences that we find, actually belong to 100 highly abundant taxa, and some of them are very interesting. So here's just a selection of some of the bacteria that we've identified in dental calculus, ancient dental calculus. And I mentioned earlier that the oral microbiome is a major reservoir for opportunistic infections, and we find many of these bacteria preserved in dental calculus. Now, I want to caution here that finding them does not indicate this person had this disease while they were alive. Carriage of these organisms is quite widespread, even asymptomatic carriage, but these bacteria have the capacity to cause disease under the right circumstances, for example, if the host is immunocompromised. What's really significant about this is it gives us the opportunity to study the evolution of these opportunistic pathogens because they do not preserve in any other context. And some of them are very interesting. So, for example, Streptococcus pneumoniae is a causative agent of pneumonia. Streptococcus pyogenes, that's one of the causes of strep throat. Haemophilus influenzae causes respiratory infections, and Neisseria meningitidis is a leading cause of bacterial meningitis. Now we have a reliable source to study the evolution of these opportunistic pathogens. But a couple others that we found extremely interesting are these three, a little bit lesser known. We have here Porphyromonas gingivalis, Tanner forsythia, and Treponema denticola. We have them at really high abundance, and this is potentially clinically significant because these are the major causative agents of periodontal disease today. We investigated this a little further. We wanted to know, did our ancient samples have unusually high abundances of these three taxa? And so what we did is we compared it to a reference set of healthy individuals from the Human Microbiome Project. We found that the frequency of these organisms within healthy individuals are vanishingly small. Very, very few copies of these bacteria are present in healthy people. But our ancient individuals had much higher frequencies of these bacteria. This did make sense, however, because we'd actually selected these individuals for study because they showed osteological evidence for periodontal disease. But what was interesting about this is we were able to show that despite a century of intensive efforts to prophylactically treat periodontal disease and prevent it, we still see the same organisms that are causing it over a span of more than 1,000 years. Now, one of these organisms, Tannerella forsythia, we actually found at such high abundance that we were able to reconstruct a full draft genome, and we're now investigating it to try to understand the evolution of this pathogen through time. In addition to the bacteria that are present, I mentioned before that we do find some really interesting other material there. It turns out dental calculus, like dental plaque, acts as a kind of sink for all the other things that you put into your mouth, including host biomolecules, as well as food. And talk really quickly about the host. Early on, we noticed that we were seeing human DNA within dental calculus, and this was really interesting to us. We just published a study last month where, using a capture-based approach, we were able to enrich for human DNA and reconstruct full mitochondrial genomes, in this case from a Native American cemetery from Illinois. This is potentially actually quite impactful, especially in North America. There are many tribes who do not allow genetic analysis of skeletal remains because it is a destructive process. But if dental calculus can serve as a surrogate, it may be a way of conducting ancient genetic analysis without disturbing the actual skeletal remains themselves. We also find a huge abundance of human proteins within dental calculus, and this is where it gets extremely interesting. Most of these proteins, I've color-coded them by sort of what their function is. Most of these proteins are colored red, and that's because they are part of the innate immune system. What's interesting about this is that by having proteins, we get an additional level of information. We are not only identifying that we have human proteins, but many of these proteins are specifically expressed in different cell types. In this case, many of them are specific to neutrophils. So we can identify the source of these proteins as a specific immune cell that's reacting to dental calculus. And so what we're actually visualizing here is evidence of an active infection at the time of death. Now, in terms of diet, it's long been known that microfossils, plant microfossils, and animal microfossils preserve within dental calculus. So all that little bit of bits of food that get stuck between your teeth, they actually stick around for a really long time, and we can see them under the microscope. So what you're looking at here, this is a little bit of connective tissue from some sort of animal tissue this person ate. This is a phytolith. It's a little piece of plant glass. These two here are actually intact starch granules. This one, the morphology, is consistent with the plant tribe Tritici, which includes things like wheat and barley. And this one has characteristic structures of the plant family Fabaceae, which includes things like peas and beans. We can also extract DNA from this and get even higher species level resolution. So this particular tooth came from a man who lived in Germany about 1,000 years ago, and in his teeth we found evidence of sheep, pigs, cabbage, and wheat, and therefore conclusively demonstrated the German diet has not changed much in more than 900 years. We can also isolate proteins from dental calculus to investigate diet. One of the most interesting ones that we have found so far is this one called beta-lactoglobulin. Beta-lactoglobulin is specific to milk, and as a result, we've now been able to test more than 100 individuals and identify the presence of dairy throughout Europe, dating back to at least the Bronze Age. We published these results last year. We're building on them now, and our goal in the next phase of this project is to try to understand the origins and spread of dairying in the Middle East and Europe. What's also amazing about proteins and using this approach is that because it's sequence-based, there are sequence variants that are species-specific, and we can actually distinguish cattle milk, sheep milk, and goat milk and have a very fine-scale resolution of how these dietary practices changed. So if you'll pardon my pun, I think we've only scratched the surface of where we can go with dental calculus analysis. And one of the most exciting things that I find about it is its ubiquity. So dental calculus is found in all known living populations today, and we find it ubiquitously in skeletal assemblages from the past. It's also found on Neanderthal teeth and the teeth of Australopithecines. It's actually quite abundant on chimpanzee teeth as well. And I think by studying it, it can provide a unique window, a lens through which we can better begin to understand the evolution of our ancient microbial self. So thank you very much. I'd like to thank these people.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.